killing them, cookies and other dangerous foods. I talked about parents needing a philosophy of food and eating if they're going to protect their precious offspring from the hazards and the harms of the standard American diet. SAD, standard American diet. It's pretty sad. Well, you know what's true is parents don't just need a philosophy of food. You need a philosophy of food. And you're going, Eve, all I can do is make it through breakfast. You know, at least you've gotten me to eat breakfast. I mean, that's a huge big start on health is when you make the commitment to eat breakfast. You know, we grow up hearing that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. And then the more we learn, the more we realize how true that is. But really, the type of breakfast is of paramount importance. You know, breakfast means break your fast. Of the previous 10 or 12 hours or however long it's been, most of which you slept through, you know, some of us are chewing on something right up until the point we get to bed. So the fast may only be lasting 8 or 9 hours. But skipping breakfast creates pre-diabetic changes in insulin function, raises total cholesterol, raises low-density lipoprotein, the bad cholesterol. If you just have coffee or juice or a bowl of sugary cereal or, you know, just some French toast with syrup on it, that might not be any better. If you want to improve your blood sugar levels, curb your appetite, and lose weight, it's essential that you eat a protein-rich breakfast each and every morning. People who eat a couple of eggs for breakfast are less hungry for the rest of the day, and actually for even the following day. And because they're less hungry, they eat less. People who have an egg and toast breakfast will actually eat 420 fewer calories over the following day and a half. We have so many calories available in America today. Everywhere you turn, you can grab another 500-calorie bite of something. It blew my mind when I was in New York weekend before last. You know, they now have the regulations that they have to put the calories next to the dishes. And so I went into one of the popular coffee joints to get a chai latte tea. And I looked on their board, and their chai latte tea was 370 calories. And you can bet that stopped me right in my tracks when I saw that 370 calories on a chai latte tea. And I just ordered myself a black tea and went over to the stand and put a little cinnamon in it and put a little milk in it. And I'm a fan of stevia as a sweetener, something I keep in my purse. And I put that in it. And so I ended up with a 10-calorie cup of tea instead of a 370-calorie cup of tea. It's real easy for us to grab those extra calories. But maybe you don't like eggs. Well, you can have a few bites of leftover chicken or some other high-protein food. I often recommend to clients that they make salmon patties for breakfast. Easy peasy. Remember, all the salmon that's in a can is wild salmon. Make a nice salmon patty. You make 6 of them out of a can and have that for breakfast. Doesn't have to be eggs, but it needs to be protein. When you have a low-glycemic, sugar-free cereal such as oatmeal, as long as you don't put, you know, 10 spoons of sugar on top of it, you can add extra protein and do it by stirring in some whey protein. Take the powdered whey protein and just stir it right into your oatmeal after you've cooked it. You can take that same whey protein and stir it right into your yogurt. Remember, yogurt contains 1 gram of protein per ounce. So if you eat a 6-ounce cup of yogurt, you get 6 grams of protein. But if you stir in a scoop of whey protein, you could turn that 6 gram of protein cup of yogurt into a 14 or 15 gram of protein cup of yogurt. And that's going to hold you a whole lot better. But, you know, what's the message here? We need a philosophy of food. And that structure that we create about daily habits and principles that define our relationship with food and guidelines that steer us towards specific food choices is something that we really need to live with every day. And we need to do it because we got some global problems here. You know, Americans now have the dubious honor of being the fattest people in the world. It was interesting when I wrote this column for Natural Awakenings this month about, you know, killing kids with cookies. And I spoke to my noble editor, Jason Cross, who's done a spot-on good job with this publication. And Jason said, you know, you said fat kids at one point in the column, and, you know, I had to edit that out. I had to put obese children or something like that because we can't call them fat kids. Well, you know, I used to serve on the Sarasota Science Advisory Committee, and they invited me to the meeting that when they were going to start the program for Sarasota County on childhood obesity and make some declarations about it. And we had a very fancy, very notable speaker that was there with charts and graphs and lasers and arrows showing us these incredibly complex body fat measurements that can be done with children. We can't use traditional BMI charts, basic metabolic index or body mass index charts with kids, because kids have a slightly different water ratio in their tissue than adults do. And as a result, their relationship of their square inches of skin to their body and how much fat they should have is slightly different. So anyway, this expert was stood in front of the Science Advisory Committee and showed us with her charts and whistles and bells and lasers and everything how we measured these kids. And so I had studied when I lived in Colorado with one of the world authorities on obesity in children. And she taught me that what you do is you look at the kid. And if the kid looks fat, the kid is fat. Well, suffice it to say, they never invited me back to another meeting of the Sarasota County Science Advisory Committee because that was apparently not politically correct to say that. But since overweight and obese people now outnumber the undernourished and starving, I think it's time that we pay attention to what the World Health Organization says when they say that there's 1.7 billion adults that are overweight or obese. And way less than that that are actually undernourished. In England, 39% of the population tip the scales as overweight and 21% obese. And where's the line there? And again, that's the body mass index chart, which actually I think is kind of a funky chart because that chart says if you're this height, then you should weigh between this mark and this mark. And while it's in the good general category in terms of that weight, what I find out is that when I put people on a bioelectric impedance analysis machine, which is something that I use in my clinic on a fairly regular basis, we actually measure how much of your body is muscle, how much of your body is bone, how much of your body is fat, and how much of your body is water, and whether that water is inside the cell or outside the cell, which really talks to us about what sort of toxic load that you have. And so I find that the body mass index chart is not as accurate as we would like. It's a good initial screening device, but there are some people that just really, really have a lot of muscle, and as a result, they're not going to fit correctly in the chart. And there are other people who have high toxic loads, and as a result, they have a high amount of fluid in their body because their body's trying to dilute those toxins, and they don't fit on the chart. But fundamentally, if you get that body mass index chart and your body mass index is greater than 25, then you're considered overweight. And if it's greater than 30, you're considered obese. So, you know, when we look over the last 20 years, the incidence of obesity has tripled in developing nations. The dramatic increase in overweight equals a dramatic increase in diabetes once we adopt this Western dietary habit of overeating cheap foods that are loaded with calories from sugar or sugar-like carbs and the gnarly ingredient trans fats. It may sound funny, but in Australia, officials have recommended a full-scale effort to strengthen toilet seats in order to accommodate the growing numbers of overweight people. In the United States, it's even difficult to take x-rays because too much body fat obscures the image. You know, there's over 120,000 United States citizens, over 10,000 people every month that get their stomach stapled or gastric bypass or other surgeries to lose weight every month. Well, what we're learning is that this obesity epidemic is driving the diabetes epidemic. And when we look at the fact that 250 million people worldwide have diabetes, a phenomenon that just really rocketed up from barely 10% that just 20 years ago. 30 million people had diabetes 20 years ago. Now 250 million people do. That number is expected to climb past 400 million in the next 20 years. And how does that, if you say, well, Eve, that doesn't affect me. I don't have diabetes. Nobody in my family has diabetes. I'm not overweight. It doesn't affect me. Oh, yeah, it does. And the reason that it does is because of the number of healthcare dollars that are spent in America on caring for individuals who have diabetes. You know, when you look at the challenges to the kidneys and to the eyeballs and to the heart, we clearly look at a circumstance where that money is going to come directly out of your pocket to help to care for those individuals. So, yeah, we've got some denial in terms of our little poochy belly, but there are long-term consequences of having abnormal numbers. Can you be fat and fit? Can you be heavier than average and still be fit? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But we're going to look at certain markers like blood pressure and elevated cholesterol and inflammation in general. And as long as those things aren't existing, then that's a great piece of news. So you may be a little fluffier, as my mother used to say, than most people and still have very good health. And on an annual basis, you will make certain checks of your blood levels. You'll check your fasting glucose, and you really want to get your fasting glucose under 100. You'll check your fasting insulin, and ideally, we want to get your fasting insulin down below 10. We're going to check your hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is also called glycolated hemoglobin, and it really talks about how much blood sugar has damaged the proteins in your blood. It really gives you a picture of what your glucose levels have been over the previous 6 weeks instead of just what they are when they pull the needle out of your arm and you get your fasting glucose number. Like fasting glucose and insulin, it's a really simple test, and it reveals something that a single fasting glucose test might not reveal. When we look at normal hemoglobin A1C, we're looking for a number, perfect number would be less than 5%. At the point that we're looking at a number above 7%, we know the individual is diabetic. Normal, about 4.5 to 5.7. So the hemoglobin A1C test has certain advantages over a fasting glucose test, because if you ate a lot of sugary foods the day before a fasting glucose test, it'll throw off your results. But the hemoglobin A1C provides your average over, you know, several weeks, about 6 weeks in general. You know, there's other useful medical tests that tell us what your degree of fitness is, everything from triglycerides to glucose tolerance to C-reactive protein. You know, I'm a big fan of testing both hsCRP and CRP. hsCRP is high-sensitive C-reactive protein. It identifies chronic low-grade inflammation that substantially increases our risk of developing heart disease and having heart attack. I had a client on the phone on Saturday, and he's a client of mine that lives out of state, and he got his hemoglobin A1C numbers, and the particular lab that he used listed the range from 5 to 16 as being normal. And yet the research says we need to get hsCRP. Did I say hemoglobin A1C? I meant hsCRP. We need to get our hsCRP under 8. So when we look at all of the markers that we have in our blood, anything that's under the averages is better for your health overall. But why are we having so much problems? Well, first off, food isn't what it used to be. Our foods have changed. They've changed considerably over the years. You know, when we went from eating whole grains to eating white flour, from using sugar to using high fructose corn syrup, from using fats to using trans fats, we changed our diet. You know, the ancient diet of human beings consisted of whole foods. And this is the type of diet that we're best suited for biologically. You know, in the distant past, there wasn't anything refined or processed. No foods came in boxes or cans or bottles or jars or bags. There weren't fast food restaurants, fattening snacks, or rich desserts. Our ancestors hunted for meat. They gathered vegetables and leaves and fruits and nuts. So we've had a mismatch between our biologic requirements for food and what we actually eat. And those dietary changes started thousands of years ago. But in the last 108 years, I mean, I can draw a line in terms of 1900 and see that refining has accelerated significantly. Industrialized food is the main. So that didn't just begin when the millers started separating the wheat germ from the starch. And the whole grain brown bread gave way to, you know, fluff and puff bread, as I call it. Remember, when you mix white flour and water, what do you get? Yep, you get glue. And guess what that does to your bowel? And then a few years later, we started bleaching the flour so that we could turn brown flour into white. So the combination of refining and bleaching removed or destroyed most of the nutritional value of the whole grains. And similar techniques were applied to the refining of sugar. So we really aren't eating the same diet that we evolved on. You know, we got even worse 25 years ago when these low-fat and zero-fat diets came into popularity. Those diets were almost always high-carb and high-sugar diets, with the additional carbs and sugar further propelling people toward diabetes and pre-diabetes. So the average person's food consumption actually increased by several hundred calories over the last 25 years. Fabulous article in the New York Times a week ago Sunday on the fact that we just have so many more calories available to us now. So there really is a calorie alert. We have bigger portions. We have more snacking. You know, this is part of the problem, is that food portion sizes have increased immensely. It enables us to consume far more calories and carbohydrates each time we sit down to eat at home and in restaurants. My husband and I went to the movie yesterday, and I only go to a couple of movies a year. And, you know, I was amazed when I went in and the small bag of popcorn was $4. And we got the small bag and shared it between the two of us, without any butter, I might add. But I saw a family that each one of them got the giant tub of popcorn. Now, I'm not saying it's a large box. I'm saying it's a swimming pool full of popcorn, and all of them got it with butter on it. Well, you know, when you have 3 cups of Air Pop popcorn, you got about 130 calories. You got a really good and healthy snack. It's actually a whole grain. But by the time you had the tub, the swimming pool of popcorn, and you put the butter, or what was claimed to be butter, who the heck knows what was coming out of that pump with that yellow slime that they put on top of it, we're talking about individuals eating somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 calories. And I'm here to tell you, they were in the row behind us, and every single one of those tubs was empty when we left the movie theater. What was amazing to me in a study that was done a couple of years ago is the bigger the container they gave to people, the more that people ate. And you would go, well, duh, Eve. You would expect, no, I didn't expect that. I expected at the point you feel full, you stop. But if you have a big container, you eat 50% more than you would otherwise. But the amazing part of the study was they put stale popcorn in the big containers, and people still ate too much. So the actual size of the portion that sits in front of you really does make a huge difference. That's the reason that I say that these all-you-can-eat buffets, and actually buffets in general, I mean, they are a member of the evil empire, because it's almost impossible for you to go to a buffet where they have some of everything and not want to try some of everything and end up eating hundreds, if not 1,000 calories more than you really need. Then we got the issues with hidden calories and carbs and soft drinks and juices and coffees and my chai latte, for that matter. We really want to understand that the body doesn't register very many of the calories that we get from liquids. our body's designed to eat our food, not drink it. And so when we take a 12-ounce can of soda pop, and or most, you know, any of the soft drinks that are sweetened with high fructose corn syrup, it has an equivalent of 10 to 12 teaspoons of sugar. So just one can of soda pop put you on a fast track toward prediabetes. So we want to consider soft drinks as a source of really stealth calories. They sneak up on you. You know, when I was a kid growing up, those sodas were sold as fountain drinks. They were a real novelty, or and they were in those 6.5-ounce bottles. Remember those things? And then in the 1950s, they increased the bottle sizes to 10 ounces and 12 ounces. Now, 12-ounce cans are hard to find. They're kind of the pygmies of the supermarket soft drink aisle. Now we get the 64-ounce bottles that dominate the supermarket shelf, or the double-gulp soft drinks at the convenience stores. Now, granted, not everyone drinks an entire 2-quart bottle every day, but some people do. And a 2-quart bottle of soda contains 800 calories and a 0.5 pound of sugar. Did you hear me? I said 0.5 pound of sugar. You know, we think that, oh, we're going to have lemonade, and lemonade's going to be a whole lot healthier. But it provides practically the same quantity of sugar. If you drink the whole bottle, you get far more sugar than you would in a glucose tolerance test at your doctor's office. You know, the highest quantities of sugar in soft drinks go to the orange sodas. A 2-quart bottle of Orange Crush weighs in at 960 calories and more than 0.5 pound of sugar. That's half the calories that most people need without any redeeming nutritional values. But the ultimate winner, I thought Orange Crush was it, but I was wrong. It's Sunkist. 1,040 calories and 2/3 of a pound of sugar. You know, when we look at cranberry juice cocktail, we'd think, well, that's a whole lot better. But it contains 1,040 calories and more than 0.5 pound of sugar, nearly all of it coming from high fructose corn syrup and not from cranberries. In fact, a 2-quart bottle of 100% grape juice contains 1,360 calories and 3/4 of a pound of sugar. So these so-called healthy drinks and juices really aren't any better. I'm always blown away when I see individuals that slug down these 8-ounce cans of Ensure, of which, you know, they've got, you know, 20% of the calories are coming from fat, and lousy fat at that, and 18 grams of sugar and 22 grams of other carbohydrates. So there's 160 calories of the 250 calories that's nothing more than sugar. You drink 2 quarts of that and you got 2,000 calories, 400 of which are from fat. So when we look at soda pop, we really want to look at the idea that we are dealing with the biggest, one of the biggest problems that exists is the amount of calories that we're drinking from soft drinks. There is really a soft drink addiction out there. You know, when I look at the people that have a presentation of chronic fatigue syndrome, I have to look at the love of soft drinks as being one of the rocks I have to look under to see what the causes are. Because it's not uncommon for me to see people in my private practice that drink 3 cans a day of soda. They don't realize that they're adding up to 80 pounds of sugar every year. Because they turn to me and they go, oh, well, it's just a few cans of pop. But when we look at the addiction that people have to soda pop, you think, oh, well, they're going to be a whole lot better if they have a sugar-free drink. But people who consume 2 or more cans of either regular or diet soft drinks daily are 50% more likely to become overweight or obese than they are with people who don't consume soft drinks. So when you say, well, Eve, it's a whole lot better for me to have a glass of cranberry juice cocktail than it is a soft drink, I say from a calorie standpoint, from a sugar standpoint, I don't think so. That little teeny tiny bit of extra nutrients that's in there seems like chump change compared to the danger that they present. So look at that philosophy. you know, starting out with eating breakfast, eating at regular times. You know, I have a 12:30 to 1:30 lunch break in the clinic. And pretty much every day, you can count on the fact that if you walk into my office at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm going to be in the lunchroom chewing. You know, there's so many pressures at work and at home to sabotage your intentions to eat well. You really need to claim the time to eat. You need to be vigilant about eating at regular times, granting yourself this time, just as you would if you had to go to the toilet. You know, food doesn't just provide fuel for your brain and your body, but when you don't eat, your adrenal glands think you're stressed out. I try to eat a very well-balanced lunch every day. I sit down and eat a full meal. I'm not much of a sandwich eater. I may eat a sandwich once a week. But today, I've got leftover brown rice that's got some Thai chicken sausage mixed into it, little peanuts in there. I've got some raw salad left over from Saturday night that's got lettuce and cabbage and tomatoes and onions and cilantro and celery in it, nice and crunchy. So I've got a cup of raw veggies there, and oh, there's some leftover green beans in there as well. So I got my starch, which is my brown rice. I've got my protein, which is the Thai chicken sausage and the peanuts. I've got 2 servings of vegetables, the leftover green beans, and the leftover salad. And that finishes cleaning out the refrigerator for the weekend. And that's pretty much what I do. I always try to cook a little bit too much food so that I've got enough to take into work. You need to eat slowly. You need to enjoy your food. You know, the time pressures and the anxieties that they generate really force people to eat quickly. So I can't say that I have a leisurely lunch. If you've ever been in my clinic, you know that busy is our middle name. But it's not fast food land. It's not quick to serve and quick to eat. You know, because the faster people eat, the more they eat. So if you want to eat less, then you need to eat slower. When we look at the nature of eating well, we begin to eat smaller portions when we take that plate and we divide up that plate into fourths, with a fourth of that plate being protein and a fourth of that plate being starch and 2/4 of that plate being non-starchy. It's easier to eat smaller portions when you start thinking about having that plate divided up like it was when we were in grade school. You know, without clear indicators, it's not easy to figure out reasonable portion sizes. You know, when I talk about a modest serving, a size of a deck of cards of protein, or the palm of your hand in vegetables, or the size of your fist in a piece of fruit, some of those things don't quite get through to people. So get out your measuring cups. Measure what 1 cup of pasta is. Measure what 1/2 cup of coleslaw is. Physically look at it. Get used to seeing it, because that's an important daily habit. But, you know, the other one, a part of our food philosophy, is choosing your snacks carefully. I think that there are individuals repeatedly that can eat well, and then they turn around and they have lousy snacks. You know, we always keep jars of nuts and seeds on the counter. My hubby is fond of cashews and almonds, and we also have a nice container of Brazil nuts. Remember, a Brazil nut a day keeps the cancer away. It's high in selenium. So 1 Brazil nut every day is my recommendation, especially in protection against skin cancers. But it's still important to limit the quantity you eat. If you overeat them, you're still going to be in trouble. So, you know, it's my rule is the amount you can close your hand around, not a fistful open-handed, but a fistful closed-handed. But having popcorn in the house and having whole grain crackers in the house and low-fat cheese and some hummus or some black bean dip, having good snacks there helps you to avoid jumping in the car and running out to the, you know, convenience store to pick up some sort of a slimy thing. But be mindful of what you eat. You know, when I see people driving through some of the fast food joints, they don't consider that there are other meal options. They don't consider that they could have something other than a burger and a fries and a soft drink. If you're a mindful shopper, you begin to read labels. You begin to understand what the calories are, what the nutrient density is. But, you know, the principle that I always talk about is eat as close to nature as you possibly can. You know, here's a chicken and here's a chicken nugget. This ain't rocket science, boys and girls. You know, you don't even want to know what they do to make a chicken nugget. You know, I talked on the 4th of July show about what they do to make a hot dog. I've had a number of comments about that since that particular show. So when we look at the nature of what's in some of these foods, you know, in one hand is a potato and the other hand is a Pringle. You can't call that a potato. You know, they have done gnarly things to a potato to turn it into those kinds of artificial. They're not even real potato chips. In your philosophy, one of the things you truly want to embrace is eating a diversity of foods. You know, people get into such a rut when it comes to their eating habits. They have a tendency to eat the same vegetables, the potatoes, the peas, the corn, the carrots, over and over and over again. They miss out on the endive and the arugula and the watercress and the asparagus. And they miss out on some of the very high nutrient density foods. So challenge yourself to try things that are new. You know, you don't have to cook a whole new meal. Just cook a new dish. Just cook one new dish every week. That's always my goal, to try one new recipe every single week. If I try 52 recipes in a year, and probably I don't do that, probably I try 40 or 45 new recipes in a year, then at the end of the year, you're going to at least have a couple dozen good ones to add to your repertory. Always opt for fresh foods. Anytime you can choose fresh over above what comes in a box, in a can, in a jar, in a bottle, in a bag, then they've undergone less processing. Fresh foods typically look like what they did in nature, a sign that it's been minimally processed, minimally handled. But most foods that are sold in boxes and cans and jars and bottles and bags have, well, added sugar or sugar-like carbohydrates or trans fats. You know, canned foods tend to have a high glycemic index, a more sugar-like effect, because sitting in water breaks down some of the fiber. So opt for fresh foods and opt for a huge amount of diversity. And don't take food for granted. You know, over the last 100 years, many nations have made tremendous strides in sanitation and hygiene, resulting in a food supply that is, you know, mostly free of disease-causing bacteria. And then we open up the paper, and we find out that even an incredibly reliable and respectable organization as Whole Foods has just done a 1.2 million pound beef recall. Coleman, one of the best organic and natural meat processors in the United States, turns out that they ship their cows to Nebraska Beef for processing. Nebraska Beef has had charge after charge after charge against it for lack of sanitary conditions causing recalls. And so don't take food for granted. You know, even though those companies and fast food restaurants follow very stringent rules to avoid bacterial contamination of food, it still doesn't mean it can't happen. Don't assume that fast foods are safe to eat because they're prepared in clean kitchens. Don't presume just because it comes to you from a reputable merchant that it can't be contaminated. It still can. That's why I always talk about how important your stomach acid is. We've talked before on No Nonsense Nutrition that the purpose of stomach acid is not simply to digest your food, specifically your protein. Because stomach acid doesn't really digest your apple or your piece of toast. Stomach acid fundamentally works on proteins. But the fundamental function of stomach acid is it's part of your immune system. It's there to sterilize your food, not just to break it down. So when you've got good quality stomach acid, you give yourself some protection against bacterial contamination of food. Whether it happened on the farm, whether it happened in the kitchen, or whether it happened underneath your fingernails. Don't assume anything about the food that you buy. Just because you bought a bag of dried cranberries thinking that they would be a nice, fancy new addition to your salad the last time, and you think, oh, they're all loaded with vitamins and minerals, and the next time you buy a bag of cranberries, you don't look at the label, and you didn't find out that they added sugar to them to make them sweeter. You gotta look. When we need to read the fine print. We really need to reject any food with unhealthy and unnecessary ingredients. You know, on Saturday I was reviewing a diary with one of my clients, and the person was having a reaction, and it appeared that they were having a reaction after they were taking their pharmaceutical drug that was prescribed to them by their doctor. And we got out the PDR, the physician's desk reference, and we looked up the drug, and the drug had artificial colors in it. Both of the drugs that this particular client was taking had red dye number 5 in it. Now, I don't know what the blue blazes that we have to be putting dye in our drugs, but it turns out that that was what the reactive agent was for this client. So when you're buying food, you want to read the label, but guess what? Even when you're buying a pharmaceutical, you need to read the label, because there are unnecessary ingredients that can be present in there. Eat organic food as often as you can afford it. And you know what's true is organic foods have come down in price so markedly over the last 20 years. And as every time you go to the grocery store and you spend a dollar on organic food, you are giving a message to the stream of food manufacturers that you want more of that. I was thrilled when I saw an advertisement on TV the other night for Pizza Hut using organic tomato sauce. Now, I can't put that company on the highest list of healthy, but I can say that that is going to create a tremendously greater demand for organic tomatoes in the United States, and that means more farmland will not have pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides, lowering the carbon footprint, lowering the damage to wildlife. So even though it's not the company I'm going to give the AAA pluses to, I still have to give them kudos for increasing the amount of acreage in the United States that organic food is grown on. Furthermore, by the time you take the soda pop and the chips and the slime food out of your basket, you got plenty of money for organics. But the most important things for you to buy as organic are the things that you use the most of. If you eat a bowl of cereal 365 days a year, please, please, please buy organic cereal and put organic milk on it. An acre of soil only has so much nutrition to give. And so when we look at high-yield farming, where they're trying to put out as many pounds of product as they can, then a lot of pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides are going to be used, which in turn reduce the plant's productions of vitamins and other antioxidants. Every time you buy meat or fowl that is grass-fed or range-fed, you're going to have a healthier fat profile, really similar to that of wild salmon, supporting better insulin function, promoting weight loss as compared to the saturated fats in the omega-6s. You know that the ability that we have to choose wisely means that we need to eat more vegetables and less meat. Our planet cannot continue to support the amount of meat eating that we're doing currently. So I'm not saying you have to become a vegetarian, but what about being a part-time vegetarian? What about just reducing the meat portions enough that we can reduce the demand that we're putting on our planet? You know, farmed fish are fed grains just like corn-fed cows are. So we're still in a situation where we're supporting the corn industry. You know, maybe the reason that the bag of popcorn was $4 at the movie last night was because so much corn is going into ethanol production, something that the country, the Congress, has made a commitment to, but now we have to rethink it. You know, at the point that we've got people going hungry, are we really wise to be using that corn to inefficiently manufacture fuel? you know, as we create this philosophy of food and eating, not only to protect our precious offspring, but to protect ourselves, we want to make sure that we're eating nutrient-dense foods so that we can make every bite count. You know, the sugars and sugar-like carbohydrates provide few, if any, other nutrients. So when we look at increasing the density of overall nutrition on the plate, making sure that every bite we put in our mouth is nutrient dense. You know, I had that fresh organic papaya with some fresh organic raspberries and some blueberries on it and some organic plain yogurt as my breakfast this morning. Got my good protein out of that yogurt. Got those bright colors, each of which are different antioxidants to be protective. That's a really nutrient-rich meal. I had a nice organic roasted chicken last night, a leg and a thigh and a wing last night, and a piece of butternut squash and some spinach. It was delicious. Why do we need to do anything fancy to this food? The food itself is high quality. And when I speak about high quality, we always want to remember some high quality protein in every meal. As long as that protein isn't dredged in flour and deep fat fried. For those of you vegetarians, I always remind you, you can't be a successful vegetarian without beans in the diet. So, you know, my emphasis is first off on eggs because it's the cheapest protein you can eat. I mean, we just cannot get high quality protein as good as we can with eggs, and not just for breakfast. What about egg salad? What about an omelet or a quiche for dinner? And clearly, chicken and turkey are much lower on the carbon footprint scale than beef, pork, and lamb. They're all great protein sources, but let's look at 14 lunches and dinners over the course of the week and try to think about having at least four of them as vegetarian meals. Maybe four of them as two-legged animals, like chickens and turkey, and then that just leaves us two meals a week of four-legged animals, like beef and pork and lamb. Reducing your carbon footprint and still eating some high-quality protein at every meal. But you know, if I was going to have one banner that I was going to wave in the parade and hang over my head, it would be the banner that says, eat more vegetables, eat more vegetables, eat more vegetables. You know, the vast majority of Americans don't even eat the five recommended daily servings. Depends on whose study you read, but 70 to 90% of people don't do that. And I don't recommend five daily servings. I recommend at least nine. I'm trying to get people to eat a quart of vegetables every day. Yeah, a quart, 4 cups of vegetables every day. It sounds like a ton if you're not a big vegetable eater. But as you turn into a bigger vegetable eater, yesterday I made egg sandwiches for lunch. Actually, we had some fruit early in the morning and then went to the beach and came back and I sauteed an onion and threw a handful of organic spinach into it and then scrambled the eggs and put the eggs on top of that and toasted some nice millet bread and took a piece of provolone cheese and put that on the bread and then put on the egg and the spinach and the onion. You see, even in that breakfast meal, I had more than a half a cup of cooked vegetables. So by the time I had the butternut squash last night and the spinach last night, and it was lots of veggies in the day. That's what we want, lots of veggies in the day. So when we look at these guidelines and attunements to a philosophy of food, they talk about embracing the high-fiber fruits. You know, raspberries, blackberries, strawberries, blueberries, cherries, kiwis, apples, melons, grapefruit. Lots of vitamins, lots of minerals, lots of fiber, and very little sugars and starches. These are part of your nutrient-dense eating plan. Things like bananas and dates and figs and grapes and nectarines and oranges and peaches and pears and plums have far more sugar. Doesn't mean they're bad for you, just means we want to eat them a little less. Actually, I had a fig this morning and I had a fig yesterday, but I had a fig, not eating a bowl full of them. So you want to limit the quantity of these fruits and just get rid of the fruit juice. You know, just get rid of the fruit juice. You know, in January when my orange tree comes in, I might make orange juice twice a week, a little tiny glass of it. Just the amount that I would eat of that fruit, it's a novelty. But especially if you're trying to control weight, get the fruit juice out. Look at healthy oils. Look at healthy fats. Making sure that for cooking you're using olive oil and macadamia nut oil, things that are high in the anti-inflammatory omega-9s and low in the inflammatory omega-6s in the saturated fats. If you need an oil for high-temperature cooking, macadamia nut oil is one of the ones that has a higher smoke point, should work fine. Also, light olive oil instead of extra virgin olive oil. You know, those high-quality fats that are found in salmon and tuna and sardines and other cold-water fish, even 2 servings a week reduces your risk of stroke by 40%. Look at how simple a philosophy can be for food. You know, just doing things like drinking water and tea. I love it when people come in and they say, I don't drink water because it's boring. That's why I drink soft drinks and coffee. Loaded with sugar and caffeine that affect blood sugar and insulin levels and stress levels. Sure, you can have 2 cups of coffee, but stop there. But sugary soft drinks, hey, they're a liquid candy bar. And so we need to find some yummy flavored herb teas that are acceptable to us that we can use instead of a soft drink. You know, when I look at the number of people that walk around carrying a bottle of water instead of a soft drink, I'm pleased, even though they're paying a premium, $4 to $7 a gallon for that bottle of water, and there's way too many of those empty bottles filling landfills. As far as your health is concerned, nothing could be better than simple water. Yeah, it's a big list. It's a big list, but at the same time, it's a philosophy. Eating breakfast every day, eating at regular times, eating slowly, enjoying your food, having smaller portions, choosing your snacks carefully, just being mindful of what you eat, having a diversity of fresh foods, not taking food quality or food itself for granted, not assuming that just because you bought a bag of something last month, it's going to be the same as the bag you buy this month. Read labels and get as much organic as you can. Try to eat nutrient-dense foods to make every bite count. And get high-quality protein at every meal with plenty of vegetables and high-fiber fruits. Use high-quality oils and fats. You know, it is a philosophy.